A quick note before we start. About 70% of all people who listen to the show on Apple or Spotify don't follow the podcast. If you like the show, please hit that follow button. It ensures that you don't miss an episode, and it really helps spread awareness of the conversations we're having. And if you can leave a comment or a rating, that's even better. Thank you. Okay, let's get back to the show.
I'm Andrew Kitley, and this is my podcast, The Invisible Gift, a show about turning disability into possibility. From a young age, I was told I had a disability that would make it impossible for me to achieve and flourish in life. I struggled in school and felt I was not truly understood or supported. On my long road to becoming the owner of multiple businesses, I have learned that dyslexia was not my disability, but rather my invisible gift. My dyslexia challenged me every day, but it was also what made me into an independent thinker, a creative, and gave me that hard-working mindset that has taught me to never be discouraged by failure. I realised there are many people out there just like me. So I wanted to learn more about them and dyslexia itself. I realised I needed a way to do this which was great for dyslexics, which obviously rules out writing anything down and makes total sense why a podcast is perfect. I'm excited to be sharing this journey with you as we learn more about dyslexia, the incredible people that thrive with it, and how we can all transform our greatest challenge into our invisible gift. Welcome to my podcast. This week on the podcast, I'm excited to be joined by Paloma Ford. Paloma is both a teacher and an award-winning entrepreneur. She has worked with children with neurodiversities for over 20 years. Her business, Screening for Dyslexia, pushes for early detection for dyslexia in young children. Coming up in this episode, we talk about the fascinating link between dyslexia and autism and how they overlap, the creative flair that dyslexic people seem to show, the most proven and effective methods of teaching children, and the important topic of encouraging parents to get their children tested. But first, I asked her why and how she started working with dyslexic children. Paloma, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
You are a specialist in dyslexia. Would that be a correct thing to say?
Yes, I would agree with that, yes.
And what made you do that? Because as I believe, you're not dyslexic yourself. So what made you get into this field?
I always knew I wanted to be a teacher. I was very lucky at the age of 16, and I knew that I wanted to go down the path of working with children with special needs. So that was the first step. And then I think it was about 15 years ago, I was running a learning support department, and I met a lovely lady called Pat Dixon, who knew a lot about dyslexia. And then I didn't really know too much at that point. And then found it very, very fascinating, especially when I knew the stats, and then kind of went from there, really.
You started in autism first, though, is that correct?
Yes. So I worked for 2 years at a mainstream school because they say that's what you should do in your teaching career. Mm-hmm. Handed my notice in before I had another job because I thought I'll just go for it and get something. And then I had an interest with working with children on the autistic spectrum, and landed a job working in a primary school, working for children. I think they were like year six at that time. Quite an interesting job, very hard work, but loved it because every day is different and very challenging.
So what would you say is the biggest challenges you faced when you first started in your career with working with either the autistic children or dyslexic?
God, one of the hardest things, challenging things, was it's wanting to do the best for them and figuring out what that path is, because we know every child is different, but children with special needs, it's a lot harder because, especially with children on the autistic spectrum, there's a real range. So you've got ones that are high functioning that can talk to you and tell you their frustrations. And then I've worked with students that literally were non-verbal. And it's quite sad to see because it felt like they were quite trapped. So it's working out ways of communicating. So using a lot of visuals and learning Makaton, and yeah, so
what's Makaton?
So Makaton is
sounds like an Egyptian god.
Oh, yeah, possibly. So Makaton. So I was taught that at school. Actually, they did training at my first school. So basically, obviously British Sign Language. So it's a kind of spin on that, but very basic. So you are literally signing with your hands and using keywords.
And that's for
children with autism?
So mainly children with autism, although my experience is, so working obviously in the field of all sorts of children with special needs, anyone with got speech difficulties, communication, social. So a lot of children, so even ADHD, so you might get children that just need things to be broken down. So it's just quite handy that they can listen to you as well as see your signs. For example, stop, come, sit, eating. Yeah, it's fascinating.
Do you just work with children with dyslexia now?
Oh, gosh, that's a really good question. I'm going to say no, because I've got my finger in a few pies at the moment. So I'm still working in a school, but not a specialised school now. So I'm back in mainstream. So obviously in every classroom, we've got a variation. So from that aspect, I'm still working with a whole range. But my own work, as in when I'm doing tutoring, I'm only working with mainly children that are dyslexic. But some of those are possibly on the spectrum as well. Hmm. But I won't work with anyone privately that's not got a special need.
We spoke earlier and you said there seems to be a lot of overlap between dyslexia and autism.
I think it's about 40%, I think.
Wow.
One of the things that fascinates me is that, so a lot of children, they'll get their diagnosis. Hmm. So we know now that a lot of children can be detected quite early on. Mm-hmm. So about 18 months to 2 years. And then it seems to me that it's just personal opinion. I think sometimes they just get that label and then they'll say, right, that's the diagnosis. Off you go. And then as the child gets older, there's more problems with reading and writing. And I think they still will assume that's due to the autism, or actually it could be dyslexia as well.
What's the age people are really finding out these days that you have dyslexia? You're being diagnosed. I don't like using that term, but
I know
you're being diagnosed with dyslexia.
At the moment, there is the majority of children, they will tend to diagnose around 8. Hmm. Some 7-year-olds will get in there. The reason being is because there has to be an assumption that the child has been exposed to all of their, for example, their phonics and all that key stage one infant learning. So at the end of, probably going to get a bit technical now at school, but at the end of when a child is in key stage one going into juniors, they will have finished their 5 phases. So they've been exposed to all of that learning. So by the time they go to juniors, there is the assumption, right, they pass their phonics screening test. So until they've had all of that learning, that's why a lot of education psychologists will be reluctant to diagnose. Although saying that, my whole thing that I really strongly believe is you don't need a diagnosis to start an intervention. So catch it early.
When I found out I was dyslexic,
yeah,
it sounded like a disability, like you're going to go blind in a few weeks or something like that. It was like horrendous for me, because at the time no one really knew what it was. It was almost it's a new word, I might be completely wrong, but at the time not many teachers really knew what to do about it. It was quite a new thing. How do kids take it these days, and parents, when they find out? What's the reaction from a diagnosis?
Still, I would say I still think there's a lot of negativity around it. I think there's a lot of work for people like myself that are fighting to rebrand it, can I say, or twist it around to the positives. Mm. I think parents still have huge anxieties. A lot of it, we were saying earlier, so it is hereditary. So I think there's a lot of guilt. So if a parent finds out my child's dyslexic and they're dyslexic, I think they battle with themselves. Like, is your family, are they dyslexic?
Yeah, so my dad's severely dyslexic. And when I got told I was dyslexic, he was like, what's that? That's just thick, isn't it? And I was like, yeah. Aww. And he still says now, so when we talk about it, he says, isn't that just a way of justifying why you can't do something? So I still think that runs through a lot of people. I mean, he is 71 now, so probably not got that much more longer to moan about it. But yeah, so they I don't think they knew how to deal with it. My mum is unbelievably intelligent. She's on the other side of it. So she couldn't really comprehend it. But my brothers are all like me as well. Just slightly. Yeah, my oldest brother's probably a bit more like my mum, but my other two brothers are definitely dyslexic. So it's just it was just normal. So the fact that apart from my oldest brother, we all just got bad marks and school weren't great. Well, say school weren't great. I loved school. And I think a lot of people I speak to when we do these podcasts all seem to have loved school, because I find that dyslexic people have powerful kind of social instincts. So they become popular at school quite easily and things like that. Not all, but a lot of them. So that actually brings me into another question. Is there a trait that you like, that you see in dyslexic children that you don't commonly see in other children, that you like a particular one? So I'll give you an example. When I used to teach martial karate, different martial arts, but karate was my main one. And we used to have kids with ADHD and other learning disabilities in one class. And the one thing that I loved about that class, kids always say hilarious things anyway, but they were ultra funny and said really abstract things at weird times. And is there a trait that you regularly see with dyslexic children that you like?
I would say the one thing I often see is they really do have an amazing imagination. Mm-hmm. I think they're really verbally strong as well. So whereas I work with lots and lots of children that find it really, really hard, and they'll say they've got it all up there. I've got it all up here, but I just can't get it down on paper. Mm. Well, let's take the paper away and you just tell me, you just talk to me and tell me your story. And the minute you can do that, you can literally see they're kind of like, oh. And it's just, it fascinates me even now that they can just sit there and they'll have like a really good imagination. They can see a clear story. And often I find they are very good, which will relate to you as well, is they're really good with their hands as well. And they're quite good at seeing things or puzzles, which is amazing. So I know from, obviously I'm not dyslexic, so it fascinates me. I'd love to get inside your mind and just see how you perceive the world and what you can do and how you construct things, which is so, it's such a talent.
It's been so interesting hearing Paloma talk about the natural creativity of dyslexics. I think it's so important to talk about the common positive traits of a dyslexic as well as the negative perceived traits. That's one of the reasons why I started this podcast. By the way, you're listening to The Invisible Gift, a show about turning disability into possibility. As you've heard in the podcast, reading and writing definitely isn't for me, but this method of learning resonated with me much more. I was curious to understand how parents generally reacted when hearing the news that their children had dyslexia. Back to Paloma. Do you think, from your experience, dyslexic children would be best taught in an environment with predominantly other dyslexic people, or do you think it's better to mix the classes?
Oh, Andrew, that's a great question. Well, I'm going to say, because I work in a school and of my knowledge and my expertise, so at the moment I'm back in a mainstream school and I already know the children that haven't got a diagnosis, but I suspect, so we know that stats are about 10%. Mm. So I would say that with the right adjustments and the right interventions placed in a mainstream setting, there is no reason why a child with dyslexia can't be successful. Mm. But that's easy for me to sit there and say, because at the moment I'm doing that and I'm able to provide that. And then you go to another school where you might have somebody who's not as experienced. You might not have, the school might not have the funding, might not have the resources. I speak to a lot of parents each week and they're saying the school's not going to do anything until the child is 8. So you're dealing with that, which I totally disagree with. But the flip side of these special schools, and I know there's quite a few, and I think that is a growing area.
An expensive growing area, apparently.
I was just going to say, financially, obviously very expensive. There's one I heard of recently. A parent was asking me, so I kind of went online and had a look. yes, it did look amazing. And if what they're saying they're providing, then brilliant. So it's a really hard question. I also think moving on probably to things like self-esteem and anxiety. I know we touched on that earlier when we were talking. If you're sitting with like-minded students, I think that could benefit you in some ways, couldn't it? If you're sitting there in the class and you've got other children that are dyslexic, so you can have chats about that, that might help you. But then on the flip side of that, I think it's really good to have a complete mix as well. You know, sitting in a class with a child who's got ADHD and, you know, we've just had a new child that's joined us in September who's on the autistic spectrum. And I think that's really good for the students to know that and to experience that.
So this is what I was going to say. A lot of people actually assume I'd be more for the separation. But I think the one thing I learned from being a dyslexic is I learned about bringing a team around you really early on. I wouldn't have said that when I was younger. I wouldn't have known to say it like that. But I realized if my friends that's really good at that and my other friend's really good at that and my other friend's good at that, then they can all fill in these gaps in my life and I can do the other things that they're not good at. So even at university, if we had a problem, they know not to give me the work to solve. I mean, give me the work to do, but I could come up with a solution, but they would happily go away and do all the work around it. And then we would get a good group mark because the solution was great and the work put in was brilliant. But if I was to do that on my own, the solution would have been great. The execution would have been horrendous. But they would have done great execution, but with no idea. So I learned really early on.
About teams.
And if I was in a school with just dyslexic people, I wouldn't have known that was what I could do because everyone else around me would have been exactly the same.
Just hearing you say that, just pinged in my mind. One of the great stats is thinking of teams and how it all works is 50% of NASA employees are dyslexic. And I say that to parents a lot and I go, but there's a reason for that, isn't there? There has to be because of their different talents as well as the non-dyslexics. And it absolutely works.
Well, then they say MIT is the dyslexic university. I think a lot of dyslexic people struggle with, and I'm sure a lot of people who are listening will understand this, is things like revision.
Yeah.
Because I could never revise. It didn't matter how hard I revised. Then I met Christina I went to university and I was learning civil engineering and I had to study for a test. And when I was studying, she was like, "What are you doing?" Oh, sorry, I was revising for a test. And she was like, "What are you doing? That's not revision. You're just rereading your notes. That won't do anything." So she brought loads of study cards that are different colours and she knows nothing about dyslexia. This is just how she processed information. So she brought me loads of study cards and got me to write out all the different things, subjects on them and move them around as I was studying them. And she was like, "Oh, you just need to go to a revision group and they will teach you how to do this." I didn't even know that existed. I just didn't know that was a thing. And from then I've been able to revise a lot more than I could before. And I think a lot of dyslexic people automatically say, "I can't do that." Yep. So they write it off. It's like, I am guilty of that because I was saying about names. I'm bad with names. And people always say, "Oh, you forgot my name." And I'm like, "No, I'm just not very good with names." And I write it off. Whereas I think a lot of people say, "No, you could be good at names. You just need to learn the skill to learn it."
Just listening to that story about the revision cards, because I also work, I'm contracted to work like not many hours at Kingston University. So I'm lucky enough to work with adults on the autistic spectrum and who are dyslexic as well. And obviously students, one of the big things that they really struggle with is actually revision. So it's giving them those tools and just exactly what you just said, because one of the things, strategies I always say to them is, right, because you've got to revise, but you've got to revise in a different way. So whether it's the other one is using a dictaphone so you can listen to yourself and then put your headphones on and listen back is a really good method, as well as the old coloured post-it notes. It just works.
I have that with my goals. So I have life goals and I wrote them all down and I recorded them all, and every morning I listen to them.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Because it just helps
But if, because what I realized was, 1 year I wrote them down and I just read them every morning and it didn't do anything. And then I thought, that's not going to work for me. So then I recorded them and I just put my headphones in every morning. First thing I listen to when I get up in the morning. And it's me reading my goals. It's also how I got used to hearing myself recorded, because it's not nice hearing your own voice.
That's your auditory skills. We talked about that earlier. So it's that your auditory skills. So you're probably much stronger with your listening as a skill set, rather than, that's what I love about working with students that are dyslexic. I think we said that earlier, is that we use a multi-sensory approach, and parents always say to me, what does that mean? I go, well, when you're at school, which you'll be able to relate to, is you'd sit there and you're looking at the board and listening to the teacher. And so looking at the board, you're probably going to be struggling with copying from the board. So one of the ways we teach students is straight away is we take away the visual and we just talk to them and talk about the new spelling rule, whatever it is. So they're, you know, it's their listening skills, and you can really see them. You know, it's quite heightened.
So how do you go through the different methods of learning? Do you have to keep, when you deal with children, do you have to try different methods and find the right one for them? Or is it generally a more recognised method now?
There are different, I mean, it depends, because I describe it as a spectrum, but only my experience of working with a whole range of students. So I've got some that are severely, I would describe them as severely dyslexic, where there is that concept that have to literally overlearn something. And I'll often say to parents, as long as you can get your mindset over that and accept it, that it's not going to be a quick fix. So for some children, it'll be a lot more kinesthetic, a lot more hands-on. I think we talked about earlier about the alphabet. There's a real assumption, again, that once you hit a certain age, so let's say you're 6 or 7, a child, they'll just assume that they know the alphabet, and I'll be like, they probably don't. So let's, and I still use it now, a wooden alphabet, literally the letters. So some children, they just need to be handling the letters, looking at them, closing their eyes, feeling what they feel like. And yet others can, so maybe the ones that are not as severe, you can literally teach them spelling rules, because we know that there's typically doesn't affect intelligence, and often they're quite highly intelligent. So it's actually teaching students a spelling rule. So for example, if I told you that the letter W, I will talk about W, just an example, that letter W, it's a really naughty letter. It's got 3 rules. And people and students will go, and even parents will go, really? And I go, yeah, you have to learn the rules. But if you can teach that to a dyslexic student, they'll get it.
What's the three? I need to know the 3 rules of W.
Well, it's things like was. If I said she was what, want.
Yeah.
And if you're looking at me and I'm saying to you what was, want,
yeah,
it sounds like there's an oh coming out,
yeah,
but it's not, it's an ah. Now, if you're dyslexic, which you are, imagine now you're a child and you're trying to write those words, because you're writing it phonetically, because that's the thing that's happening in your brain, I'm assuming. It's teaching a set of rules, so you'll be like, okay, so the first rule is we've got W with spelling with the letter A, but it sounds like an oh. Now, that sounds a little bit complicated at the moment. You're sitting there going, okay. But for actually, if I was teaching that to you in a lesson, we would spend a whole lesson looking at that, listening, looking at the sound of our mouth, a shape of our mouth. It is fascinating.
It's been so interesting hearing her opinion on the difference between state schools and public schools. I absolutely agree there's a conversation to be had on the merits of each. This conversation also came up in last week's podcast with Chris Donnelly.
Hi everyone, I just have a quick announcement that I'm really excited to share. We're launching the Invisible Gift Community, a platform designed to provide support and resources for neurodivergent individuals. I've always been passionate about sharing conversations around being neurodivergent, raising awareness and promoting understanding, but I want to do more. So now the Invisible Gift website will offer a range of tools and resources to help neurodivergent individuals navigate the challenges any one of us can face on a daily basis. This includes information about workplace accommodations, tips for managing language and sensory overload, advice on how to communicate effectively, information for how to get the most out of a neurodivergent child's education, as well as providing the building blocks for them to have a successful life and much more. But to do this, we need your input. We are looking for therapists, influencers, business leaders, HR, and brand representatives to provide their input and support. If you're one of these people that wants to support neurodivergence, or if you just believe you can really help out, send my team an email on hello@theinvisiblegift.com and you can find more information on the Invisible Gift website. With your help, we can really turn neurodiversity into possibility. Okay, back to the show.
If you haven't heard it already, go check it out. Paloma and I continued our conversation by talking about our goals for the future. I also asked her what advice she would give parents with dyslexic children. Before that, we discussed university examinations and how other countries deal with subjects like mathematics. There's a lot of parents that kind of shield away from getting extra help from their for dyslexia because they, well, in my opinion, my parents were amazing. I said to you earlier, I couldn't do my alphabet at 12, and then my parents had no money. My dad's business was just about to go under, and he said, oh, sorry, it had gone under. He had just started another business, so we had no money as a family. And they said, right, we need to get him a tutor because it was just getting worse and worse every year. And then my behavioural issues become worse. And they got me a tutor, and I went through 5 different tutors, and I come to one, and she just was great and taught me everything and changed my life as a result of it. And when I left her, I was only with her for 2 years, and then I had reached the minimum requirement at my, so I was, I joined her when I just at the end of primary school, and then by secondary school I just reached the level, the minimum requirement for my year, so I didn't have to see her anymore. Aww. And but I, without her, I wouldn't even like to think where I am. But I find a lot of people I know who are dyslexic when they're younger, their parents wouldn't have done that. And is there a lot more support at schools now for this sort of thing?
I think it is varied. I do think it is varied. I think it depends on different boroughs. I've heard of different, some boroughs will still not recognise dyslexia, apparently. Others won't use the word dyslexia, but they will use the whole specific learning difficulty, which comes under the umbrella of dyslexia. Mm. I think there are parents that do want to shield away from it, like you've just said. I've literally, because I've obviously had hundreds of meetings with parents in the years, I've met parents that have found out that their child was dyslexic and said, we are not going to tell our child. And I just could not fathom that at all. So their child was struggling and is struggling, and they chose, and I'm thinking, why? And they use the terminology, which I still hear now, it's, I don't want them to be labelled. And I think it's not a label. Sometimes I've seen children where they look relieved. They've just gone, oh, so that's what it is. And I go, yeah.
When you sit there and talk to kids about the dyslexia or the learning difficulties, do you say, well, you can be anything? Because is there people you point to as an example of, you say, look, this is what they've done. They can do amazing things. Or do you ever have people come in and talk about it? Is that something that happens in schools now?
Not that I know of, no. I don't think we've had people come in and talk about it. I worked, one of my jobs, had many, one of my jobs, I worked at a secondary school.
Yeah.
Which had a fantastic, amazing learning support department. Some schools get it absolutely right. And they had this brilliant poster. And I think because they were dealing with teenagers, and then they the Senko there created these famous people dyslexic cards. So yeah. She laminated them. So it was people like Jennifer Aniston, Richard Branson, Theo Pathetis. Loads of them. There's absolutely loads. And on each card, it had them talking a quote about their dyslexia. And obviously, you've got actors and singers and like somebody like Richard Branson, a millionaire, billionaire, whatever he is. And the idea was that they were inspirational cards. Mm. And I thought, what a great idea.
That's amazing.
So it's like Keira Knightley, she's a brilliant. So I was thinking, God, that's so good. So when you've got some students that are feeling really like, I can't read, can't write, finding really tricky, they literally spend time with them going, right, have a look at these cards. Look, it's not going to stop you. It's not going to stop you in your path of life. If anything, you know.
So who's harder to convince, the children or the parents? Because if anyone ever told me when I was younger, you can do anything, I'd go, yeah, damn right I can. That'd be kind of like my approach to it. And I'm sure there's not all kids like that.
Kids, again, because you've got, because I deal with so many different cases week in, week out of different ranges of children. I think it really does depend on the child. I think it depends on the age. So I've worked with children that get really, really frustrated. There is a bit of an anger early on. And I think as they start to get slightly older and they see their peers being able to do X, Y, and Z, where they're finding it harder, they can often be hard to convince, but it just takes time. So again, it's just keeping up that positivity. I did mention this little child earlier, who I've got a new kid in my class who I'm sure is quite severely dyslexic, and he can't write, and he's in year three. He literally can't write, and he's been made to write since year one, reception year one and two. So he's come into our class and we've said, do you know what? I know you can't, you know, you find writing tricky. So we're not going to let him write. We just take the writing away from him. And at the moment we're rotating ourselves. So he's telling us these stories and we're just scribing for him. And already in the 2 weeks we've been back, you can see he's a different child because he had a bit of a fit. You could see there was an anxiety as in, you know, I've got to write. So we've given him a handwriting scheme so he can practice his actual writing, as in the letter formation, but writing we've just taken away. It's like a different child.
So when it comes to the specialised stuff that you've learned, you've gone away and studied this
yourself. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Can you bring that into the school environment, or you just do this yourself in your private tuitions?
So in all... Oh, God, that's another really good question. So at the moment, no, I can't teach that in a mainstream setting. So I'm teaching children. So we're teaching spelling and grammar, this, that and the other. So I'm teaching that in the whole class way. But in order to help those students that require a different type of teaching, I will then refer those children to our Senko, who's in charge of coordinating, making sure that I get given adjustments and interventions. So at the moment, those children would be taken out and have other teaching methods.
So is this, so I spoke to another professor on a podcast about this. Is this the problem that the kind of the way to get it filtered downstream is to, it's going to be too hard to get it from approval to the students themselves?
So most schools can provide, you know, things like coloured overlays, which you probably didn't have at school.
No.
So that's a really basic adjustment.
A while ago.
So that's a really, really basic adjustment, you know, using reading rulers, giving a tricky words mat. So if I've got a child that's finding it hard to write basic words like said, look, that, then I will give that child a visual tool. So there's lots of things we can be doing. But in terms of the specialised at the moment,
Would you agree? Now, so the schooling world we live in at the moment was created because of the Industrial Revolution. And a lot of teachers I've spoken to says not much has really changed in that time. And the professor I spoke to the other day said that it's, we teach students so they can go to work, and until the companies that employ them have a different skill set requirement, schools can't really change. What's your thoughts on that one?
I think it's going to be there for a long, long while, definitely. I think I think looking at the education system, you know, it is a big political question. You know, questioning exams, why are we, there's a great picture, you've probably seen it, where there's these different animals and they're trying to climb up a tree.
Yes.
That one, it's a very famous picture. Why would you test all the animals trying to get up the tree when certain ones can't? I think that's happening still the same in schools. I think there is still A long, 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 long way to go.
Do you know, I read the other day that I think it was Japan. It might be. Yeah, I think it was Japan. Don't hold any exams until they're like 6 or 7 because they said the first part of their life should be about being a good person.
Yeah.
And
respect
and stuff like that. And they said with Western culture, we're trying to ram them kids into early stages to find out where
data,
they are.
Data.
Yeah.
It's all about data. It is crazy. Exams drive me mad. Because, yes, there are adjustments. They do have adjustments now. So this child, you know, thinking of like having a reader, which would be great for a lot of students that are dyslexic. They often will use a laptop now, touch typing, extra time. Extra time drives me a little bit mad because I think if you're giving a student 25% extra time, and then I'll say to parents, that's great. But has your child been told what to do with that 25%? For example, again, probably going back to your mind and how you, if you were sitting there doing an English exam, often what students used to do is they'd get their extra time. They'd be told to change the colour of their pen. So when it gets marked, they can see what they've produced in their extra time. And 9 times out of 10, they've just carried on waffling because I've been given extra time, so I'll just carry on writing. Where actually, they should have been taught you probably need to use that time at the beginning to plan. So often we know dyslexic students will use mind maps. I don't know if you've ever used mind maps.
Yeah.
Because you're seeing things in a different light. So you would colour coordinate, work all your story out, you know, draw your little arrows. And then as it comes to writing, you've then got that as a visual tool. And that's where you use your extra time.
Who are the exams for, though? I know this is a stupid question, but as a dyslexic, I sit there and think, who are they for? Because I always say this. I said this to my niece. She's 17 now. She's very intelligent. So she has no problems with exams. Well, she'd probably hate me saying that, but it seems like she has no problems with exams. But I was trying to explain to her, you do your SATs, which I never understand what I think that's for government or possession. I don't know. But you do your GCSEs to get into college, and then you do your A-levels to get into university, and then you do your degree only to go out into a job where everyone's exactly the same, on the same playing field, and most people get employed because they had a Saturday job at Tesco's. It just seems, totally so agree. Who are these exams for?
Who are they for? It always fascinates me. It's also one of my jobs. I've worked in the private sector against the public sector, and it's really interesting to watch parents literally, sorry for anyone listening now who's got their child privately educated, but I have worked in both sectors. It fascinates me how much money they are spending and have spent on their child's education. And often I've seen children coming out, just gone to a normal state school and have actually done pretty good. And the kids have probably left at 16 and were amazing with their hands and did whatever. So, you know, who's to say who's right and who's wrong?
When I went back to university, I went as a mature student. I remember sitting in, I'd done something really bad. I went there and that's that. You had to have A-levels to get in, and I hadn't even got any GCSEs, but I've spent so many years in construction. That was kind of almost an automatic entrance. But so I sat down with the course director and he said, well, here's a maths test. This is the questions you're going to be asked. This is the sort of thing. Have a look at it. And if you think you could do really well on that test, then fine, let's do it. He said, it's up to you. I looked at it and it was like hieroglyphics. Oh, no understanding. I went, yeah, I could do that. Oh. And I started university. 2 weeks later, I start. Second week into my, because I used to go 1 day release from work a week. They gave me that test to do. And I scored 7 on it. And you know what's really funny? I was so proud of that 7 because I couldn't believe I got 7. Oh. Right. And this was basic maths. And I remember sitting there and when they read out all the results, they didn't say name. They said your student ID, which is you're the only person that knows your student ID. And they read it out. And when they said my score, the whole class, which was like 60 people, laughed their head off.
Oh.
And the teacher went, whoever's got that, you should go home now and not bother. That's what he said. Now, I agree, because I'm about to go into a civil engineering degree with only getting 7% on basic maths. Anyway, so I sat there and was like, oh, really, really just shouldn't have bothered with this, but I thought I'll carry on. And I'd done the year, and at the end of the year, we got another test. And in that year, I got 92%.
Oh, my gosh. Children will often say, including my daughter, who really does struggle with maths, you know, it's like, why have I got to do this? Why have I got to do that? Well, actually, maths is all around us, believe it or not. And, you know, we say to kids, you know, even things like just going to the shops, you need to have your money, looking at costs. So I do think there is an element of, you know, we do have to have those basics. However, it's just making sure that if we know that a child cannot access their learning by just having a textbook and a teacher at the front, then what do I need to do in order to make that child successful? All right, so if I'm teaching time, I need to give them a plastic clock so visually they can move it around and have a look. You know, if I'm doing measurement, give them proper tools to measure and stuff. So I would say there has been a bit of a push more recently on the math side. So in terms of our national curriculum, as it were, the government has actually spent quite a lot of money looking at how the Singaporeans do their maths. So they, I don't know how much you know about that. So they've changed it all and they're using this word mastery. So the idea is if you find, let's say, telling the time quite tricky, the idea is that you would carry on learning that until you've mastered it.
Well, Asian countries do maths completely different to us, don't they? They have. So I learned about the way they do multiplication is using line theory on things. And it's, and I was like, wow, where's that been all my life? Because it's unbelievable.
Yeah, there's different. I think a lot of it has come from the other side of the world. So I think we have got more knowledgeable and gone, they're obviously doing something right over on the other side of the world. So they did actually send quite a few top people, whoever they were, over to Singapore, got them studying, and there's been a lot of money spent. So, for example, there's a lot of bar modelling, if I say bar modelling to you.
Yeah,
again, very visual, really visual. And you can literally see some children going, oh, yeah, now I get that.
That makes
sense.
I can
see that because it's in a, you know, you're taking away the numerical side or the, a lot of dyslexic students I work with, they can be and are often really good at maths. Where they find the problems are, it's the word problems.
Yeah.
So, and if you've got.
So that was me for equations. So I didn't understand, A plus B equals C. That made no sense to me. But once someone explained to me that A means something, B means something, and C is the answer to them, it's like, wow. Because I remember when they rearrange an equations, obviously, there's not, they show, when you start out, there's no numbers in it. And I'm like, well, how can we do maths? There's no numbers. And nobody ever explained to me what that beginning was. You just started doing it. And that's why when I went to university, they went right back to the beginning and started again. And I was like, oh, wow, that makes sense. So them two things could be that plant plus this water. That makes sense now. That's why it's not a number.
It's, we call it, so just from what you're describing, I often say to parents and I'll say to the teachers or staff that I'm working with, it's a step-by-step approach. So you're literally breaking something down. So you'll go, right. And for example, like a maths problem, because often you'll have a, we'll call it a one step or a two step. So I'm reading a problem and I know that I need to do an addition on that bit and I need to do a subtraction there. But in order to be able to do that, you've got to break down, haven't you? So the child has to understand the language.
Well, for me, I always ask, and I know this is like what kids do, I always ask why. That's what I want to know first.
Yeah.
I want to know why we're doing something, because if I can understand the destination we're getting to, why we need to get there, then I can buy into what we're doing. And I still do that as an adult. My question is always why.
I think that's a really good thing. I really encourage it at school. I'd love children to be a lot more wise. You know, again, if you're thinking about the classroom situation where teach, 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 you know, the kids have got the sparks are the ones that are going, oh, yeah, but why? I think, oh, great. You know, I want you to question. I want you to respond. In fact, one of my lessons that we teach, we have to look at the language. So it's the we're going to read, we're going to reveal, we're going to react. And then what does Mrs. Ford want you to do? I want you to respond. You know, we're really going on those keywords. And that's where often the dyslexic students do really, really well because they are verbally strong.
I always remember every lesson that I enjoyed. And I don't remember any lessons I don't enjoy. And when I speak to people who aren't dyslexic or didn't struggle at school, because there's obviously people that struggle at school that also aren't dyslexic. Yeah. So, but no one can really remember anything. I can't remember nearly anyone I went to school with. I don't even remember some of my friends' names I went to school with. But I remember the lessons I love. It's like, it was like, we did a physics class and they was teaching you about, the speed of sound and the speed of light, and we'd done a test on the field so you see the light way before you hear it. And I remember every word the teacher said through that, and I could map out where all the different students stood because I remember that so vividly.
It was the physical side, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you've just said you were taken outside, so suddenly, and it's a hands-on. So again, it's that probably multi-sensory approach. You're looking, you're listening, you're touching. So it's that kinesthetic. So that amazes me also about memory, because we know that a lot of children and adults with dyslexia have a weak working memory. So there's certain things, they'll often have like issues with their short-term memory, but yet you can ask them things from years ago or whatever. So I've got students that probably can't find it really tricky to write, and yet they're amazing at, they can tell you things now about history. So they're watching the horrible histories, for example, which is brilliant for kids. And again, like it's like YouTube, so it's the visual. So I'm using my auditory skills. I'm watching, I'm buzzing, and they'll remember that more than being told today we're doing about proper nouns. And
I used to love history because we watched videos nearly every class. How could you not?
Exactly.
How could you not love that for a class?
Exactly.
What would be the biggest piece of advice you give to parents? Because I know we probably won't have that many children listening, but we'll certainly have their parents listen. What would be the best bit of advice you'd give a parent if their child was dyslexic?
So a lot of the parents I see, they're suspecting that their child's dyslexic. Mm. And there's a large percentage of parents that will sit on a niggle and they will just sit on it. Then they'll go, oh, just wait, I'll wait, I'll give it another 6 months. They might catch up. And then it gets another 6 months. I would say act upon it now, because 9 times out of 10, if you've got a niggle, if teachers have got a niggle, if a Senko's got a niggle, if a parent's, it's normally right. So the quicker you can early detect that there's something not quite right, it means you can just start adjustment straight away. Surely you'd be better off giving an intervention, a multi-sensory approach to learning, to a five-year-old rather than waiting till they're 8. That's 3 years gone of their life.
And I think these days there's a lot more out there to help them as well.
Loads
and
more.
People like you to help them.
People like me hoping to help.
So the podcast is called The Invisible Gift. What is it to your mind that is the sort of superpower of children that come into being really professional? What's their gift? What's the biggest gift you think it gives?
Oh, the gift. It is the superpower, isn't it? Am I allowed to say that? Yeah. I genuinely do believe. So when I heard that it is called the invisible gift, I am actually going to start using that as my new motto, saying it to parents. I think often it is creativity. Dyslexic people are way more creative. And when we talked about that path, you know, if I'm faced with something, I'm probably just going to go down a straight path because that's the easiest method for me, where you are more likely to go a slightly different route, which will be way, way more creative. And I'm never going to see that perspective at all. And yet when you probably show me and talk to me, I'll just be like, wow, how on earth did you find that? Where did that idea come from? And you were probably more likely to say to me, I could just see it. And we as the non-dyslexic people on the world just don't have that at all. And I am jealous of that. And I think, what an amazing gift. So actually, I know you've had all your struggles and listening to you telling me your background of school, and unfortunately, you're not alone. And I think there'll be loads of listeners out there that are sitting there going, yes, that was me, that was me. And I feel really sad for that. But I also feel so pleased that you are, in a way, inspirational because you are so successful in what you do. And it's amazing.
So
and
you're making massive waves in the dyslexic world at the moment. Where can people find you? What have you got out there where people can read up about you or communicate with you?
So I have a little business. I'm a little business owner called Screening 4, as in the number 4 dyslexia. Mm-hmm. So I do what it says on the tin, is similar to another product. So yeah, you can find me on a website. This year I'm doing lots of webinars now. So I'm really opening up and doing parental and professional workshops to help spread the word. And just my whole mission in life is just early intervention, early detection, and let's just get help for those kids. Children like you when you were a child. That's all I want. I just think I'm so passionate about it, and I just think we need to just spread the knowledge, and it's just not a negative, it is a positive, because there are so many positives.
Sky's the limit.
Sky's the limit.
Well, thank you for coming on. It was great speaking to you.
Thank you for inviting me. Thanks a lot, Andrew.
This has been such an insightful episode. I've loved hearing Paloma's thoughts on educational reform. I think we need to concentrate on identifying children with dyslexia at an earlier stage so we can help support them in the working world. Giving them the right tools to help them grow and make them awesome is the most important thing for us. Thank you, Paloma, for coming on the show. All I can think about is if I had teachers like you when I was at school, how different my life could have been. On next week's episode, Rod Nicholson. Rod has committed his career to the subject of dyslexia. I'm sitting down with him in a couple of days' time, and I've got so many questions and things I want to learn from him. Just a couple of quick notes before we go. They're important ones. First off, make sure to subscribe to The Invisible Gift wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically be notified about new episodes. One thing that's really important to me is to hear what you guys think about the podcast. I want to hear more about the challenges you're facing, what you're trying to change in your own life, work and family, and hear your inspiring stories of how you've overcome the odds to achieve the incredible. I know, because so many of you are dyslexic, that asking you to write something to me is not going to work. So I've worked with the production team on The Invisible Gift, and we've come up with an idea. Grab your phone and record us a voice note. If you've got an iPhone, use Voice Memos. On Android, the options are endless. Once you're happy with your message, you can email it to me. My email address is andrew@theinvisiblegift.com. I would love to start sharing some of your audio notes and stories in future episodes. Also, and I'm really excited about this, head to theinvisiblegift.com, because that way you can see the amazing artwork that has been commissioned to go along with each episode this season, and also find out more about each of the guests I've had the pleasure of speaking to on the podcast. If all of this is way too much for you, I get it. I'm starting a newsletter that includes all this and more, and it will come straight to your inbox. It's so simple to sign up at theinvisiblegift.com. You've been listening to The Invisible Gift podcast, presented by me, Andrew Kitley, and produced by One Fine Play. This episode was recorded by Kazra. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Kazra is the audio and visual engineer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Special thanks to Christina, Izzy, and the Cube Studios. Thank you for listening to The Invisible Gift podcast.